health and happiness, something we all want. In order to do so, we as humans must have some basic needs met. Our topic today will address one or more of our basic needs. I am Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, with Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist, co-host of this program, Health and Happiness, on 95.9 FM, KGVM, and KGVM.org. Thank you to KGVM, and we always thank the Montana Psychological Association, who asked for a public education program focusing on mental health and health in general. Dr. Suzanne now introduces our distinguished guest, who will also address the health of our community.
One of my favorite mayoral quotes is from Clint Eastwood, and it goes like this: winning the election is a good news, bad news kind of thing. Okay, now you're mayor. The bad news is, now you're mayor. And Lyndon Johnson once said, when the burdens of the presidency seem unusually heavy, I always remind myself it could be worse. I could be mayor. And today we speak from High Country News. A recent news story reported that Joey Morrison, a 28-year-old social worker, spoke to us about his housing organization, his lifelong efforts as a Montanan, and he will become our next mayor of Bozeman. He'll serve for 2 years as deputy mayor and then step into the top role January 2026. We're so pleased to have Joey with us. Welcome, Joey. And perhaps you could share with us your background for this new job and how all of this came about.
Yes, yeah, thank you for having me. And I love a nice open beginning question. I grew up in eastern Montana, grew up in the big city out there, Mile City. Came out here to go to school. While I was here, I left with sort of a sampler platter of degrees. I left with degrees in history and anthropology. I dabbled in biochemistry, left with a global health minor. I was a pre-med student. Really just sampled around with a lot of different things because, one, I liked school well enough, but really what inspired me, what kept me going, what made me say, whoa, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life was working for agencies in town, like the Warming Center, like the Help Center, like Haven, that overlapped a bit with my time at the university. So most of my professional experience is working with people that are in serious struggle, working with folks that are experiencing homelessness, with survivors of domestic and sexual violence, creating programs that are preventative to those types of instances, as well as most recently coordinating the overnight operations of our shelter here in town for folks experiencing homelessness with the Warming Center through HRDC. So that is, I think, one of the pieces that led folks to identify me as someone that they wanted to see run for office. So it didn't just pop into my mind. It took other people around me saying, hey, why don't you think about running for city government? A number of mentors and supporters and friends of mine were encouraging me, and I said, no, absolutely not. That seems horrible. That seems like the worst idea out there, especially because I had just sort of found my voice as an organizer, as a trainer, as a mentor to other folks. And I liked being behind the scenes. I was finally in my element of not having to be at the front of the room. And then they're asking me, hey, would you go be at the real front of the room? That was unnerving, but obviously I eventually said, yes, I'll give this a try. So I ran for city commission in 2021 and lost, but learned a ton. Learned a lot about so many of the political organizing tools and electoral tools that people have said are dead are not dead. Like canvassing, like knocking doors, like meeting folks at tailgates, like meeting folks out on the street. Those are alive and well, and were essential to both the lifeblood of the Tenants Union, Bozeman Tenants United, that I helped to found, as well as the tactics that we deployed in my campaign that were extremely successful. And we would not have won if we didn't run it in the way that we did. Both because we knew that that was a winning strategy, but also it was the kind of campaign we wanted to run. One that was based in the community, one that revitalized the legitimacy of door knocking, of talking to neighbors, of bridging political divides, of bridging arbitrary moral divides, that is kind of carried into the mandate that I feel like I carry now with each vote that I'm trying to cast as a member of Bozeman City Commission. So that's a sort of a fairly condensed story of how I got here, but I think those kind of cover the core elements of how I'm sitting here in front of you today.
And you had a really strong victory, and you had a really strong team helping you canvass. And yeah. To anyone out there, particularly young people, how do you feel that that strong coalition came together? What's the secret that you have?
What's the secret? Yeah, that question I've gotten from everybody, from folks that are working on, you know, Senate level campaigns down to other local races and things like that. And the short answer is there's no secret sauce. It came from hard work. It came from talking to one another. I will say, with some of the pieces that I think have built the legitimacy for me as a candidate and why folks said, yeah, I'm going to give time to this guy. Because we had folks, you know, we had single moms who were working two jobs who still said, I'm going to give this campaign my Thursday evenings until election day, because this is an investment in my ability to stay in this community, getting somebody like this. And I think part of it came from that I believe fundamentally in just the concept of representative democracy, that the people who are affected most and first by decisions should have their chance to pull the levers that affect those choices. So working class folks, young folks, tenants, folks sleeping on the street, folks like that are affected most and most severely by the decisions that we make at City Hall. And so I believe those types of folks that have lived those experiences should have their say in how those decisions get made. That, I think, built a legitimacy in folks. There wasn't a sense of, oh, I'm trying to save anybody, because I'm kind of doing it for myself as well. Like, I don't have generational wealth that I'll get to stand up on at some point. I'm working and fighting to make this community my home in the same way that a lot of people in this community are. And this community has been, you know, serviced by the labor of people like me that keep this town running, that pour the beers, that clean the streets, that keep folks healthy at the hospital, like that type of thing. And so when we started the campaign, we really had somewhere between like 4 and 9 volunteers last like June, July. And we were like, well, we got to build this out. This is not going to be sufficient to knock, you know, 10, 15,000 doors. By the end of election night, we had touched a little over 150 unique volunteers. So from 4, you know, roughly, let's say 7 or 8 volunteers to 150 volunteers that had to have been, you know, that came with our organizing craft of bringing folks in, finding folks that have a stake in this, letting them know you have a way to be able to make a demonstrable impact on the community, and this is one of them. And then developing them, giving them responsibility, just plain old grassroots organizing tactics. And they turned out to be really successful. And that folks trusted that I wasn't going to get into office and turn my back on them, because, you know, it's not like I get into office and I'm suddenly a millionaire. I get in office and I get paid, you know, the commissioners get paid like 20 grand a year. So it's not like suddenly we get in and we can afford, like someone like me can afford to turn my back on fighting for working people, because that's still who I am. And I think we've seen all across the country, when you put people in office that are directly affected by the problems that they're trying to solve, they act with a different urgency than people who just cerebrally understand the problem, but they do not feel it. And so having somebody in office that feels it, I think, was really important to folks.
That's excellent to hear, and kind of somewhat amazing to hear that segue from 7 or 8 to over 100. And I think what you're focusing on is the issues that you were supporting brought people in, because those were their issues. Mm-hmm. And Bozeman and the state of Montana recently hit really high on the homelessness mm-hmm. list, somewhere around number one,
yep.
number two.
Yep.
So I feel assured that that's one of your main mandates, Joey.
Yes. And I talked about this a lot during the campaign that, you know, affordable housing is not going to be solved in one term. Like, by the time I'm either running for re-election or on my way out 4 years from now, I want to know that I pulled the right levers, that I've made the impact on affordable housing that is possible for my position. But homelessness we are in kind of our no-go opportunity right now. Of either we do really ambitious things and novel and innovative things to address homelessness in a new and really deeply pragmatic way, or we don't, and this problem continues to blossom and get worse and worse and worse. And so that feels like over the next 4 years, we have real opportunity to make changes on. One of them that the commission has been talking about is effectively regionalizing. We talk a lot about regionalization, of saying, you know, problems don't end at city limit borders or at county borders or at state borders. And so regionalizing our efforts of bringing in Belgrade, bringing in the county, bringing in Whitehall and Three Forks and West Yellowstone and Big Sky into these conversations about how we manage homelessness, both from what are ideas that folks have? What are the structures in place? What are the programs that people have in these various jurisdictions? But also, what are the resources that we can pool together? Because every time us managing a shelter here in Bozeman through that HRDC is doing benefits Belgrade, it benefits Three Forks, it benefits West Yellowstone. And so making sure that we're coming together and recognizing the collective benefit that we have of treating homelessness as a public safety and a public health issue is essential to being able to grapple and build the resources that we need to be able to address it in a meaningful way. There's a lot of different ideas that are, you know, sometimes in the short term, medium term, long term. Rapid rehousing, transitional housing, those are huge. Potentially exploring the ideas of like safe designated public RV sites, public campsites, and things like that are managed by the city, whether that's through permits or what have you. There's a million models that's been done across the country to varying levels of success. But I think just I want to continue reiterating that we are still in the phase where this is a manageable problem, but it does mean deviating a bit from what we've done in the past, which has largely been criminalizing it, letting law enforcement be the main interaction that they have with social services, and then effectively allowing the private sector to deal with it, like a nonprofit, like HRDC. And so ponying up together with other public sectors and the private sector, I think is really the only way that we can go forward.
This is another one of those things that it takes a lot of money. Mm-hmm. That where do we find it? Is it increased fees or taxes? A federal grant, state grants, private? All of those are possibilities?
Yes, those. We certainly can't really leave any stone unturned in terms of how we want to resource something like this. What we have seen is that really there's some monies that come to help shelters and things like that. Some of that comes from federal money. Some of that comes from state money. At the moment, there doesn't seem to be additional federal monies that can be allocated to homelessness efforts. So it's about being creative. You know, could it be trying to get an EPA grant that allows us to put solar panels on top of a shelter, which means they're not having to pay, you know, they're paying less in utilities. So then that money can go to another part of it. That's sort of the part that we also have to be creative about, is what are the things that we can do that aren't traditionally pieces that just fund shelters, just fund housing, but still can be a part of this puzzle, that can still be grant compliant and things like that. But for the shelter here, it's been almost, you know, overwhelmingly public support has kept the shelter running.
The HRDC.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We recently had Brian Geyer on, who's the head of housing over there, and he was talking about all of the many efforts. And we talked also that it doesn't just affect a person who's homeless. It affects our ability to bring in workers. We've had many businesses relate to us on this show that they can't find the help they need. And so it behooves the community as a whole to look at the bigger picture, which is not just a homeless person, but people who might come to the community and be our workers who can't afford to come here.
Yeah.
So it's also affordable housing for those who are looking. And so have we got a plan going or initiatives to maybe work on providing reasonable cost housing?
Yeah, affordable housing. Well, a quick piece of just that I meant to say with Arliss, with your question or your comment about funding and the cost, and we need money to make these sorts of things happen. The part that I also try to stress to folks, and I bet Brian said this in his interview with you all as well, it is more expensive to not address homelessness. It is cheaper in every way to get people into stable housing. Like folks that sleep on the street, the ways in which the community pays for that through a variety of different means, whether that's, you know, the folks that you know, the exposure and the elements that causes harm to us, that results in hospitalization, results in more emergency room visits, results in fire department calls, police department calls, all of these things add so much additional cost that it just truly is. It's not only, you know, I think often we try to just make the humane argument of like, this is the right thing to do. It is also the fiscally responsible thing to do, is to try to get people off of the street. But to your point, I always try to start when we talk about affordable housing with one, making sure that it's clear, like what it means. There's like lowercase a affordable housing, capital A affordable housing. There's federal definitions. There's our local definition. And also a little bit about how we got to this problem and that are existing structures. It's sometimes a little overly simplistic to just say we're underbuilt. We don't have enough units for people that are moving here, for the people that are here. There's part of the problem that is just baked into how housing has been done in America for all time. That both somehow housing is designed to be an investment that you can buy and it appreciates indefinitely in value forever, which has meant that since wages haven't kept up with that, it has outpaced now hundreds of millions of Americans that now are in this, that especially young people who can, our wages are not growing at the rate at which housing costs are growing. And so the idea of housing being an affordable commodity that is part of essential human life, like a shelter, having something over your head as a human right, is fundamentally incompatible with the idea that housing needs to continuously appreciate in value and generate revenue for people. And so as long as those two narratives are at odds with one another, there will be a limit to how the private sector can intersect and provide the housing that we need.
Because it can be additional housing, but it costs lots of money.
Exactly.
Too.
Yeah.
Rent.
Yep.
I mean, we have a certain amount of guilt. We built a home here about 5 years ago, and that's more than doubled in value. It just doesn't seem fair. I mean, you could say, well, yeah, that's great, but we'd much prefer that we just had a regular amount of home appreciation in mm-hmm. Bozeman so that more people could be part of it.
And yes, and that was a story I heard a ton. And I think that is also why it's important to have tenant representation, renter representation.
Yes.
So many folks say, oh, I got so lucky. You know, I bought my house 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And then they have limited sympathy for renters. Whereas, so I just now, as of yesterday, got my lease agreement for the coming year from my landlord. I usually try to pivot to ask homeowners, especially folks that haven't paid off their home, but if it's not paid off, like what if you had to renegotiate your mortgage at its current value every year? That is what tenants do. Tenants do have to renegotiate the cost of our existence with our landlord every single year. And if homeowners had to do that with their bank, many would say, I'd be priced out of this town. And I'm like, well, great. Welcome to the conversation. And And so that is part of the security that comes with homeownership that tenants don't get to, you know, get to participate in. And I don't think it's just like, I don't say that so that folks feel guilty for having bought a home. That's not helpful to tenants. That's not helpful to this conversation, but I think it's an important perspective to keep in mind of who, again, back to the representative democracy piece of who is affected first and worst by growth, by the rise in property values and things like that. And to that point, with land being at a premium, that is such a core barrier of getting truly affordable housing. Affordable housing right now can effectively only be built with a ton of relaxations, a ton of variances or departures from city code, subsidy, or huge tax credits. Those are effectively the only way that you can build truly affordable housing, or if a developer just wants to operate at a loss, like that somebody who wants to just build it out of pure philanthropy, which is still, in a way, a subsidy.
Yeah. Is Section 8 still helpful?
Not really. This is my experience with Section 8 is fairly limited. Partly because this is my understanding is that effectively almost nothing qualifies here, and almost nobody accepts it anymore. Okay. In a place that's okay. Appreciating value so much. But that'd be a great Brian Geyer question. Yeah. Yeah. But that was part of my understanding of years at HRDC where we just didn't really hear about it very often anymore. And I believe that it's now like termed housing choice, but the same sentiment applies that there's really just very limited places where that is applicable and helpful.
It almost sounds like we have a caste system of some sort.
Yes. Yeah, say more.
You know, kind of like an Indian one or some ancient one where you have the upper class and then lower class, but the middle class is kind of gotten pressed out of existence almost.
Yeah, where and additionally that there is like this enormous threshold that we would have to overcome to get into that. Like, mm-hmm. I think I struggle at times with folks that talk about, you know, I went to college because my grandmother told me to, more or less. She was the first in our family to go to college, and she went and got a graduate degree in the 70s, and it changed on my dad's side, changed that family's trajectory forever. Suddenly, there was just so much more opportunity, possibility that came with having that degree. And she, you know, got to work as a librarian in a public school in Billings, Montana. And that's the dream that she had for me. So she was telling me, like, Joey, go get a college
degree. Get a college degree.
Yeah. And I came out here, and I mean, I left MSU with, you know, with a fairly shiny resume. I mean, a national scholarship, several degrees, tons of volunteer, all of these sorts of things that should have set me up to be exceptionally upwardly mobile. And perhaps that would have been the case if I decided I didn't want to do anything in the sector that I had trained myself to be good at. And so that story of like, go get a degree, then you'll have it set, which is the story that, you know, that my parents got, that my grandparents got to hear, that just isn't true anymore. You know, Bozeman is my generation is the most educated and credentialed generation in human history. And yet very few of us own homes. And despite the age that many of our parents bought homes, yeah. we've eclipsed. And so that is just this really complicated problem of just that's fundamental to the American dream. Of, you know, you work really hard, you go do these things, you credentialize yourself, you build your skills, and you'll get ahead. And there's always folks, there's sort of the naysayers that they can always point to like one person who broke through, or, you know, half a dozen people, but that's not the truth for the majority of us. The majority of us would have to, you know, make real, either just completely deviate from the skills and expertise.
And encumbered with a great amount of student debt.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That just is, and, you know, my partner's in graduate school right now, for that exact reason of just, oof, hopefully this will help us get over that next hump, of training to be a counselor right now. And you know, there's just, I think one of the pieces that I hear a lot from young people, from folks my age, from folks that are working class, is a very scarce amount of hope. that these things just feel immutable, that they will be here forever. Upward mobility is kind of a relic of the past. You kind of stay in your caste. You know, you stay where you're at right now. And we know that's been documented by economists for decades now, that the upward mobility of every subsequent generation is getting weaker and weaker and weaker, despite each generation becoming smarter and smarter and smarter.
So, yes, we've been very concerned about those young people who go to college and maybe they want to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. And by the time they finish 4 or 5 years, many teaching programs like a master's degree now, yeah. They've got substantial debt, which they'll be paying off for a long time.
Then they're not paid very much.
And teacher salaries have not been commensurate. So it's just this cycle that we're in. I think some part of education for me was not just the salary, but that I could do something I really wanted to do and that would require training.
Yeah.
As a speech language pathologist, I had extensive specific training without which I couldn't have performed my duties. So there's still some aspects of an education. What about our doctors? What about our psychologists like Arliss? And we also need people like you to talk about, you need to be aware, you know, that what college degree you go into might have a big impact on where you go afterward.
And I think I see a lot of these types of cases being made, right? Of, you know, if you don't get a degree that's going to be lucrative, then you deserve to be in poverty, right? That's sort of the story that we hear a lot of like, and I got this a lot while I was running, you know, folks would email me and they'd say, well, you're a crisis worker, then you deserve to not make money. And it's like, okay, well, it's funny. It's a funny counter to like Americans value freedom. And it's like, okay, well, if we have the freedom to only work in like 4 sectors that are lucrative enough to buy a home, that is not freedom to me. That is pretty wild. And also, subsequently, it kind of brings in the idea of like entry-level jobs or a starter job or something that you just do part-time. Sort of underneath that is the idea that some people pick jobs that deserve to be in poverty forever. Whether it's teachers or nurses or retail workers or service industry workers, that those are entry level. So you deserve to live in poverty if you work in those, which is a new phenomenon. Like, I think that is the part that just folks have, especially, you know, and we don't have to get too much into like partisan politics, but certainly more arguments I see in conservatives that there just are some jobs that just don't deserve to pay a living wage. And it's hard to palate that for me when they could have done that 30 years ago and bought a house and have been upwardly mobile. And that isn't the reality for us now. You cannot be a server in a restaurant. You cannot be a chef in a restaurant in Bozeman and hope to buy a home unless you take out a big loan and become part owner of a restaurant or something like that.
Kind of the anti-union group as well.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And in fact, I've told this story before on the program. I had to go have physical and occupational therapy when I smashed my elbow about 2 years ago, just before COVID or just as that was starting. And my occupational therapist was an OTR, the highest registry level, and her husband was a PTR, registered physical therapist. And together, the two of them, even though they loved their work and they loved Bozeman, felt like they could not afford to buy a home here and were planning to move. Oh, yeah. So it's really at more than just one level. There's homelessness, and then there's trying to buy a home, which has changed so much from over my lifetime.
Yeah.
I can look back and know that we knew that we could work hard and buy a home. And that's, as you say, Joey, how discouraging is that for you in this generation?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, honestly, like, folks treat me now, now that I'm in office, they assume I'm wealthy, they assume I'm a homeowner, despite making it quite clear in my campaign, I'm neither of those things. I really don't have a real path that I think my partner and I will ever own a home. Like, that's just not really in, I'm somewhat, you know, it's not out of like pessimism or a lack of ambition. I just really am, if kind of conceded that point of just like, we'll be renters forever. If we choose to stay here. And that's sort of been our commitment to this place, is that we'll die here. And so there, you're right to just, yeah, that story of just, it's not just the lowest income bracket. This is an issue that is touching more and more and more people in this community. And we're hemorrhaging folks that are even working traditionally high paying jobs.
I would think that you would run into some obstructionism in the fact that, to be a politician is considered in most cases to be somewhat elite.
Yeah.
And, those who've been in that group, you're in there now, in one sense. And so what obstructions do you have to overcome? I would say there'd be a number.
Obstructions in terms of being sort
people's
of
a political
outsider?
People's attitude in the same elite
yeah.
group.
Oh, yeah. No, I certainly have not made friends in every political scenario I've been in, because you're right. I don't have the same deference. I don't have the same, yep, you're doing a great job, thanks for your service. Like, that drove me crazy when people would just thank me for running, thank me for being up there. And I'm like, I'm not doing this for your thanking. I'm doing this because people are struggling. And that's certainly there. Most, I think, generally, there's a level of, a lot of the folks that I, in regardless of, you know, whether they're in elected office or they're just, you know, hold some sort of organizational authority, I just lean on the pragmatism of just like, you know, you don't have to like me and I don't have to like you, but we have to make demonstrable impacts in people's lives. But one funny moment that came with from a fundraiser recently of just to that, like, oh, now I'm the political class. Now I'm like an elite. As someone said, they'd heard about me and they were like, oh my gosh, everybody said you were really young, but I thought you were like maybe 40. Like, that would still be young in a lot of the government elected officials. And I was like, no, I'm 28. And she said, so are you super smart or are you super rich? And I was like, that is someone who's been in politics for a while. Yeah. Like,
oh my goodness. Yeah,
that, just
oh,
at that level
revealing.
Of. Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. That I thought was very funny. A funny moment.
You notice a shock from anybody, like, oh, the mayor.
Oh, constantly. Yeah. That either folks that didn't know what I looked like or something like that, and then I introduced myself to them and they're like, oh, I.
Well, you know, an event kind of comes to mind here. A person by the name of Fidel Castro got off an airplane and he was driving into New York City and he said, I would not vote for the mayor. It's not just because he didn't invite me to dinner, but because on my way into town from the airport, there were such enormous potholes. And so I bring this quote to us to think about, that when you're mayor, it might seem that every single problem in Bozeman is going to be blamed on you and put at your doorstep. Are you prepared for that, Joey?
Yeah, I think that's been a funny part of this job so far. And fortunately, you know, Terry Cunningham is the mayor now and he gets more of those than I do. But it's funny to get calls from folks that are like, hey, I'm having a hard time shoveling my sidewalk. What can we do about this? And I'm like, that's not really my purview. So there is some amount of just like all of the goings on are perceived as our responsibility. And part of it is a funny comparison of just most of the prototype images of mayorhood that we have are big cities, where most are the mayor is deputized with a lot more authority than we have. We have a commissioner manager system. The city manager oversees most of those things. We are we provide executive decision and guidance and direction from the dais as a you know, majority vote, rather than, you know, there's nothing I could do about a pothole. You know, I can pass that along and maybe they'll get addressed, but that's not. And so that's there's like a growing pain. There's a frustration at times with talking with folks. They're just like, that's not really something I get to do. I understand that that's a problem, et cetera, et cetera. But all of that also to say, it's sort of part of the elegance of local government that I've deeply enjoyed so far, and enjoyed even as an organizer that was yelling at the city and saying that they should do something differently for several years. There is an elegance to the, you know, we vote differently on different things and then we shake hands and we still talk the next day, or folks take decisions that we say and they don't like it and we still get to talk. There's just like the real localness of, you know, one of the folks that endorsed me, we got lunch and he said, one of the reasons why I'm donating to you and why I want you to win is because I want just a regular guy in our local government again. Sort of a seeing that of this elite, mm-hmm. of this, mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. these folks are kind of on high, and smarter and know better and all these things, and I'm more approachable to some folks.
Is the mayor of Missoula similar?
No, Missoula has, the mayor has a lot more authority.
Oh, there. Different system.
Kind yep. of. Yep. They have a very different system and they have wards and districts. They have a much bigger city council. They have a 12-person city council, two from six different wards. And the mayor is much more the executive and administrator than the mayor is here.
You get most things done then by persuasion, not by edict, I guess, to get right. things done.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. We have to truly, you know, and even me and Terry and I, like mayor, deputy mayor, we're still just one vote each. You know, we, each of us, and should be as jealous of our one vote and never want to give it up for anything, just as I implore my colleagues to do the same, because that is what we're up there to do. We are up there to represent our own discretion, our perspective, the material that we take in from staff report, from public comment, and from our lived experience into the votes. That is just, you know, the mayor is sort of first among peers in our structure of government. And so, yeah, you got to be able to work well with others to be able to get anything done.
Well, it's not only the work that you do, but for our listeners across the valley, what could citizens do that would be helpful for you? And how would they contact you to help with some of these questions and needs?
Yes, that's a great question. We are going to be, so one of the most pressing pieces that will be kind of revitalizing over the next few months is, you know, during the election last fall, the Unified Development Code revision process blew up in everybody's face, and it became this extremely controversial issue in the community of how we amend our city codes, our building codes, and things like that. That was delayed, which I think was a pretty wise decision from the commission last fall. So now we are in the process of getting that back online, of figuring out new engagement ways, sort of new commission, new way of the way the city interacts with the public. So there will be a number of a slate of opportunities for folks to engage with the UDC process that will be as comprehensive as we can make it, that we'll be unveiling hopefully sometime in the next couple months that we're working on right now, as far as like, what are the priorities of each commissioner? What are the ways, what monies are set aside for community engagement? Like, it's trying to get all of those answers so that we can come up with a real proposal. And getting to hear from folks through public comment is always a huge asset to us. Being able to see what the community is feeling, even if it's just completely general, you know, even if it's not necessarily about an item that's coming up on that Tuesday, for folks to just write in and submit public comment. It's a funny thing of I over years of writing and giving public comment in person and writing it in advance, I always felt like it was just going into the void. And now being on the receiving end, we read it. We read every word. It's really helpful for us when we are framing our decisions, when we are looking at what the community is thinking and feeling. Of course, there's not the idea that, you know, if we get an item that there's 100 public comments for it, that's representative of the community, because that can't be. Of a community of, you know, over 50,000 people, 100 people can't be the voice exclusively, but it's still a helpful litmus test, a helpful barometer of what's going on as it relates to an issue. And we always encourage public comment. It's been a funny shift of just, wow, this doesn't go into the void. I know each of my colleagues reads all the public comment. We talk about them before the meetings. It's a huge asset to us for folks to submit public comment.
I really like hearing that you take these comments seriously. And I think we'd encourage everyone out there to think of what input they'd like to give and what agenda they'd like to see addressed. And I understand that for city officials, there is ethics training, mm-hmm. so that what you do could really benefit the people that you serve. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about that and how that figures in with how you plan and work.
To expand on the ethics training that we receive, mm-hmm. the ethics training we receive is really centered around conflicts of interest, when we disclose things, gifts. We receive gifts, you know, or folks would like to give us gifts. We deny them most of the time, just out of safety, to uphold the integrity of our votes. And that's where we really take counsel from the city attorney's department. To me, when I try to explain to people what the point of the city attorney's office is, as it relates to the commission, there's a lot of other things that they touch with the legality of, you know, developments and of transportation issues and all of these things. But for us as the commission, they are trying their best to provide us counsel that protects the integrity of the vote we make. And so there are... You know, one piece that comes to mind, though, that relates to, you know, how we're trying to engage. One of the campaign promises I made was I knocked doors. That's what I did to win. And I wasn't going to stop after I got in. So the first development, that first land use decision that came before us, I thought to myself, well, I don't know anything about that area. I don't know anybody who lives there. So I'm going to drive out there and I'll walk up and down the street and I'll knock on some doors and I'll talk to people about what they think is going on. And those are traditionally not really the norm of the city commission. They really rely on just the public comment rather than going out and soliciting. And that's a lot of what I did when I went knock doors anyway, was saying, hey, great to talk to you. This project is coming up. There's already, and it's all publicly noticed already. There's a sign and all that. And to say, hey, we'd love to hear from you. If you have an issue with it, or if you're excited about it, come next Tuesday or submit written public comment. And so those little pieces, are cascade a bit. That shift of community engagement of, whoa, these are the elected officials, and they come out and they humble themselves and they come and knock on my door and they want to hear from me, cascades out. There's a different level of, and that is a huge priority to the commission right now, is rebuilding the trust between City Hall and the public. And I really feel it feels corny, but it's just like every door we knock builds that trust more. Folks, even, you know, it's easier to end with a result that is unsatisfactory when at least you got to have your say. But when things are just done seeming perceptibly by without your counsel, it can feel like your community is being taken away from you, like something is happening without your input. And so even if I'm going to make decisions that are going to bother people, and I will, at least being able to have heard from them and they got to have their say, I think is still moving us in the right direction.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
How are you going to take care of your own stress? This is a stressful job by its nature, and a lot of alligators around.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a funny And what I've been getting a lot, I think I fortunately have come with some conditioning of working in extremely high stress environments. Yeah. I've said that, you know, through the last, you know, I'm coming up on 50 days in this job, that has been high stress. You know, we've had scandal and controversy and all of these things. And I've been like, wow, this is still way easier than managing the warming center. like, I cannot imagine, you know, truly, like, it's hard to imagine a harder job than the folks that are, you know.
Yes.
You know, I think of, like, our firefighters. I think of teachers. I think of crisis workers. This job feels easier in a lot of ways. However, the parts that I have far from appreciated is we've sort of seen a new resurgence or just a new growth of like far right hate groups in town that just say hateful stuff about and make threats of us as on the commission. I don't think there's, you know, I haven't talked to all of my colleagues, but I suspect almost each one of us has received death threats either as candidates or since we've been on the commission. And that part is just, it's stressful both from like, yes, threats, scary, that's bad, but further stressful of just like, how did we get here? Like, this is so ridiculous. Like, I, you know, and a buddy of mine was sort of defending me in to somebody else the other day, and he said, just like, Joey, you just get a beer with Joey. You know, you don't have to go on social media and say hateful things that you would never say to him in person. Just go get a beer with him and you'll find that actually you have a lot more in common than you think. And that is part of why I loved campaigning the way we did and why I still like knocking doors as an elected official is I loved talking with folks across the political spectrum of, you know, folks that are very conservative to folks that are very progressive and finding the common ground of just, hey, we want to see material change happen in our lives that benefits and makes our lives easier and better. And that, like, things around housing, around public education, around how our community operates, a lot of those things don't break down on right and left. And so those are some of the things that I'm really excited about of trying to mend some of the political division that has sprouted in this community that makes it very, very hard to pallet the hate groups that have emerged in town that are just saying, you like to, they effectively just want to discredit all of local government, which has been an agenda of, you know, the far right for decades.
As if they could do better.
Yes, exactly. That's so much of it. It's like these, the hate groups that have horrible things to say about everybody in local government, whether it's staff or private citizens who are volunteering their time serving on boards or the elected officials that have run or that are there now and saying hateful, horrific things, saying everything that we're doing is the worst thing they've ever imagined and provide no alternative. They say nothing about what should or shouldn't be done. All they have are condemnations of what's happening. Ooh. No solutions offered, which is their right, you know, and that's part of the beauty of American free speech. And also part of the, you know, the enormous problem that has been perpetuated through the dissemination of social media.
That brings me to something that Michael Bloomberg, who was a mayor in a rather large city, he said, I will say that walking down the street, getting on the subway, taking the elevator, if there's one or two people and they say to me, great job, mayor, that is a real turn on. I mean, anybody that wouldn't find that satisfying, rewarding, exciting, thrilling, I think they should go see the doctor. And so I think our part as citizens, even if we disagree with some parts of things, when we see somebody working hard to support our community, that we should all gather around, and maybe part of that answer to the question of what we could do is give Joey a warm hug when needed. And, you know, things that aren't classed as gifts that would get him into trouble, but maybe baking muffins, you know, comes to mind.
Yeah.
Because this is really a big job to take on, and we really appreciate that you're doing this on our behalf.
Yes.
Yeah, I appreciate both the words and the sentiment. It is, I certainly do not, and this is part of, you know, your question about wellness and how I take care of myself. Unfortunately, for how I am wired, and how I was raised and all of the socialization that I've received, the disparaging comments stick way more than the positive comments. And maybe that's, you know, I think that's normal for a lot of us. Yes, take it super personally.
Yeah.
The, you know, there's folks have reached out to me and said some incredible things about how I'm this huge inspiration to them, and they've never seen young leadership like me, yada, yada, yada. And I'm like, yeah, that's great. But one guy on Instagram said I'm an idiot. And that sticks out to me more than all the nice things people have said about me.
Okay, so Dr. Wood, maybe you could help him focus on the positive.
Well, I have the same problem with the personalization. We have a berm that we put in our neighborhood in a vacant lot that our children own and kind of given it to us. Well, worked hours, hundreds of hours there. And flowers, it is beautiful. We put river rock down, and everybody comes by and compliments it. It felt so good. One guy came by and said, "Boy, this is really ugly." And went on, just walked right out. Oh, that has bothered me so much.
Yeah.
And I thought, you didn't, what are you talking about? You know, but anyway, yes.
There were literally hundreds of positive comments.
Yeah.
But like you said, it's that hurtful.
Can't please everybody they say, but sure liked you, I guess.
Yes.
You
know? Yeah, exactly. I think that is, and especially that I've had such success in getting folks to like what we're doing when I get to talk with them one-on-one. But when someone's just screaming into the void of social media or Instagram or Reddit, you don't get that. And so I recoil a bit more.
One thing about these people, they tend to make their comments and they're kind of faceless because this guy took off before there was any really discussion.
Yes.
No questions answered, no asking of questions. And in your case, like somebody on social media would never probably come and tell you that face-to-face.
Absolutely. Never in a million years.
Yeah.
They'd never say it.
Yeah.
And I think that is the way that the comments hit. Because I think one piece is like, some of it I personalize for sure. That it's just like, wow, that's someone who thinks I'm bad and I'm doing a bad thing. But I think it's like one part that to like seven parts of this, like, oh my gosh, this is just eroding democracy. Like, this is a real threat to us being able to do big and ambitious things when we can't talk to one another without using hateful rhetoric, which is just pervasive. It's just like, it's unbelievable.
It's not debate either, it's name calling.
Yes, exactly. And the amount of just blatant speculative nonsense as well is just like, whoa, your local city commission, we're not running for president. You've probably run into us at the grocery store and you didn't know it. You know, we're not Biden or Trump. We are your neighbors. We live near you. You can access us quite easily. It doesn't need to be quite so reactive to that level. That came with, you know, and those are the other parts. It's like some of these get super conspiratorial where, you know, I've told this to folks a number of times that, you know, they're like, a lot of folks have driven speculation of, you know, oh, the commission shouldn't be able to vote on anything in the neighborhood of where a donor from one of those people lives, which is like, for one, the max donation to a local city council race of $400. My soul is not sold for $400. And I
get five. No.
Yeah. If it was 500, we'd be
done. Yeah.
Right.
It's the people I think about when I'm going up to vote, when I'm preparing, when I am walking around in the world, the people I spend way more time thinking about are the people, not the donors that gave me $400. It is the people who gave me $1 or $5. Or couldn't give a dime, but said, I can knock a door or I can phone bank. Those are the people that touched my campaign that I think about way more than the folks who could afford the max donation to me. Those folks will largely be fine. And so, and just like this, the conspiratorial nature of just baseless speculation that gets to be enabled and legitimized in social media because there's effectively, I mean, there's anonymity, there's no fact checking, all these types of things keep me up at night for sure. They're real threats to to local democracy that is worrisome.
Going on to a very serious topic, my daughter's been imploring me to get a tattoo for a while. And
Joel's heard of it.
You are somewhat famous for your tattoo, Joey. so it's just beautiful. I'm looking at it right now. Tell us about that and how that came about.
That is very funny.
And that's only what we see, right? There's more.
Yes, it goes all the way up and over my shoulder. Okay. It was funny. I think you quoted the High Country News article. Yeah. They were like, we have to ask about this tattoo. And I was like, oh my God, nobody's asking about it. Mm-hmm. This was in the COVID era of, wow, we can't go do anything. We can't travel. I guess I'll spend money on a tattoo. And there is a really incredible artist that is now part-time in Bozeman sometimes and splits her time between here and I think Polson. Named Megan Halverson. She's who did this, the whole piece. We did it all together over the course of about a year and a half. But yeah, it's just a bunch of beautiful, beautiful things.
It's like Montana.
Yeah, there's the backside, yeah, on the outside of my forearm is a scene of Rimrock Lake on the beaten path in the Beartooth Mountains, which now is kind of an interesting relic of, it doesn't look like this anymore. After the floods in 2022, that whole area does not quite look exactly the same anymore. So it's an interesting now moment locked in time. And then this side is just, yeah, there's just a variety of foliage and it partly came from her work that she's just incredibly
well. It's
talented.
Just elegant and beautifully done and bespeaks Montana.
Yes, it looks great.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's been a funny, there were one person that I met who works for Ability Montana. He came up, I went to one of their kind of talking about what they're up to, meet and greet kind of events. And he said, I'm, you know, the fact that you're 28, that's cool and all, but I'm just excited to have a future mayor who is covered in tattoos. Because he was also covered in tattoos. Yes. He was a veteran.
We have a couple of minutes left. Make a final statement to the people listening on KGVM Health and Happiness.
Oh, my goodness. What do you want to say? Final statement.
Yeah, we got a minute and a half. Yeah.
I don't think I have anything particularly eloquent as a final statement other than I love these opportunities. I've really moved mountains to try to make myself accessible for interviews, for talking to the community, for all of these opportunities that I made commitments to do as a candidate of saying, you will hear from me. If you get me into City Hall, you will not be surprised by City Hall. You will hear from us regularly. You will hear from me regularly. And this is just another really beautiful opportunity. And I'm grateful that y'all thought of me.
Well, I'm impressed. And thank you for your energy, your intellect, your forward-looking attitude about things, and the homeless issue, and people being able to buy homes. I hope changes over the next few years under your leadership.
And I appreciate your caring spirit. I think everyone out there appreciates wonderful caring spirit.
Anyway, to Gallatin Valley, thank you for listening to KGVM 95.9. Please listen on Monday evenings and Thursday mornings and go to KGVM, and you'll be able to listen to this program over and over because it will be in the archives. Thank you again, and good day.